From the nation's capital, this is DC Public Safety. I'm your host, Leonard Sipes. We have a really interesting program for you today, ladies and gentlemen. Intelligence sharing, what's happening within the criminal justice system, the larger arena of national and local and state intelligence sharing, how the lessons we've learned since 911, the lessons we've learned in terms of an exchange of information between law enforcement, corrections, parole and probation, and the national intelligence apparatus. We have at our microphone back again, Dr. William Sondervan. Dr. Sondervan, or Bill Sondervan, is the Executive Director for Public Safety Outreach, University of Maryland University College. They have an astounding 94,000 students there at the University of Maryland University College. And also joining him at our microphones today is his colleague, Peter Olson. Peter is an Associate Professor of Intelligence Studies. And let me give you a little bit of background about Peter. Senior Intelligence Policy Advisor to the Secretary of Defense, Assistant Director of the Defense Intelligence Agency. He was a CEO for his own consulting firm for quite some time, so we have a true expert to talk to us about this whole issue of intelligence and intelligence sharing within the criminal justice system and the larger society. And with that introduction, Bill and Peter, welcome to DC Public Safety.
Thanks, Lynn. Glad
happy to be here.
All right, Bill, let me give you the first go-round. Just set up University of Maryland University College. You have students throughout the world, 94,000. That's quite a few people.
Yes, Lynn, we do. UMUC is one of the 11 universities in the University of Maryland system, and we have classes all through Maryland. We do most of the online learning for the university system, and we also have an Asian and a European division. We have people on the ground teaching in about 26 different countries, to include Iraq and Afghanistan.
That's amazing. Peter, you're an associate professor there at UMUC, so you have this mix of people that you and your other professors teach in terms of intelligence studies. Give me this larger sense. We were discussing before the show that the listeners to this program may be a bit confused in terms of intelligence studies. What we have is the CIA, Central Intelligence Agency. We have the FBI. We have lots of organizations throughout the country at the federal level who gather intelligence information, but we're principally today talking about criminal justice system, how agencies share information with each other. My agency, the Court Services and Offender Supervision Agency, we share information all the time regarding high-risk offenders, regarding those offenders who pose an obvious risk to public safety. We share that information with the Metropolitan Police Department. We share that information with the FBI. We share that information with the Secret Service. We share that information with the U.S. Park Police and other law enforcement agency. So the bottom line in all of this, I'm presuming, is the public safety. Disparate agencies getting together and sharing information to protect public safety. That, to me, is the bottom line. Am I correct?
Oh, I think very much so. I mean, the whole investment in intelligence in the United States really was an outgrowth of the surprise at Pearl Harbor. And you know, the conviction that we should never let that happen again, and yet, of course, in 9/11 it did. There are really many communities when you think about intelligence. You mentioned CIA and the FBI, you know, both of which are probably the best known for the simple reason that that's what you see on TV and in the popular novels. But I like to think about there being indeed four different communities that deal with intelligence, and certainly the national intelligence community is one of them that comprises those that you mentioned, as well as the intelligence activities within the Department of Defense and the military services and several other department levels of the federal government. The second community I'd really think about is the Homeland Security community, which, of course, is headed by the Department of Homeland Security, and which uses intelligence, of course, for very specific reasons of keeping not only the United States safe, but our citizens overseas and our allies. The third is really the law enforcement community, which has traditionally used intelligence in limited senses to drive intelligence-led policing, but which, of course, has expanded greatly since 9/11, when we have learned that we really need to deal with international terrorists. and also with international criminal organizations that, you know, will deal in drug trafficking and money laundering and many other illicit activities. But what a lot of people, I think, don't recognize is that intelligence also is used very extensively in the private sector, in large corporations, in international corporations, to understand their environment, to understand their market, to understand their competitors, and in a defensive sense, to protect their own intellectual property and products from espionage by others. And the Chinese seem to be particularly adept at this at present.
Mm-hmm.
And also against counterfeiters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've worked with a large international pharmaceutical firm that uses intelligence to identify who is counterfeiting their products so that they can go after them with law enforcement, so that when you open a, you know, a bottle of whatever is their medicine, you can be guaranteed that it's not going to poison you.
And we could go on for the next half hour in terms of the IT community and Apple Computer and all the rest that are very jealously guarding their secrets and making sure that their products that are released without their competitors knowing about them. Bill, let me go back to you for a second. One of the things that you mentioned in prior conversations was this whole sense of sharing intelligence within the correctional community. You were the Commissioner of Corrections for the Division of Correction for the Maryland Division of Correction, part of the Maryland Department of Public Safety. Both of us work there in terms of full disclosure. And Bill, you, in terms of running the prison system, you discovered a lack of intelligence sharing and sought to rectify that with both federal and local law enforcement agencies for a wide variety of reasons. Number one, to keep your prisons as safe as humanly possible. Number two, to share that information with law enforcement and community corrections to be sure that those people coming out of prison, again, who posed a clear and present risk to public safety, that information was shared and that the law enforcement and parole and probation community knew how to keep an eye on that person.
Well, exactly right, Len. You know, I retired from the military, police, and the Army, and last job I was on the joint staff when General Powell was the chairman. And you know, we shared a lot of information, a lot of intelligence all the time. And then I was appointed initially as Assistant Commissioner for Correction in charge of security operations. And I came to Maryland, and it just really dawned on me, it just hit me right between the eyes, that we had so much going on in these prisons. We had 27 prisons with 24,000 convicted felons, and they were doing all sorts of things. But we all worked in stovepipes. The prisons didn't talk to each other. The prisons didn't talk to parole and probation. We didn't talk to the jails. We didn't talk to the local police. We didn't talk to the federal authorities. And it was all in stovepipe. And all the information that we gathered was very informal, and it was through informants and snitches and things that the warden would pick up. And there were several big incidents that happened that just really embarrassed me as being, you know, responsible for security. And I go into a lot of them, but one of them specifically, I had one of the federal agencies came to see me, and they closed the door, and they said, did you realize that one of your contract chaplains, who happened to be an imam, who was also a co-conspirator in blowing up the World Trade Center the first time around, is working in your prison as a chaplain, and he's recruiting disaffected inmates to be terrorists. And I just about fell out of my chair. And we confirmed that, and that was going a lot. That was going on along with several other things. And we got to the point where we decided we had to do something about it. And so we partnered up with the high-intensity drug trafficking area, the Washington-Baltimore area, and they helped us with funding. And the whole idea was to collect the intelligence, to analyze it, and disseminate it the best we could. So they gave us money. We hired two former NSA intelligence analysts to help us get going. I started a security threat group office. I appointed a captain, hired a civilian. We hired two retired civilians from the National Security Agency to help us, and we appointed a lieutenant in every prison. And we started this whole process of finding out what was going on in prisons, finding ways to deal with it, taking a look at it, and disseminating to others. And so we were able to do a lot of really important things. One, just a couple examples, but one of the things we did was we were able to take back the inmate phone system, which goes out on a bid to the Department of Budget and Management. And we were able then to record inmate phone calls. And once you record inmate phone calls, the software exists to be able to go in and use it for intelligence purposes to capture whatever you wanted to do. So we started doing those things. And from there, it all kind of grew. And we all started working together. And we went out and we talked to police departments. We talked to the other prisons. We talked to the jail administrators. And we started partnering with everybody. We started getting onto intelligence committees. We started finding ways to work with each other. And it was really a start, and it's really grown for them. And one of the things we also did is we were able to validate gangs in the Maryland prison system. And just as an example, what we would do is every month we would put together a list of validated gang members who were going home to particular communities, and we would share that with parole and probation and with the local police.
You know, the bottom line in all of this is because of the an individual hearing this program who is not part of the criminal justice community may say to themselves, oh, wait a minute, you know, this sounds very oppressive. This sounds almost scary. We are talking about, and I think we need to constantly bring the program back to this focus. We are talking about solely about individuals who are engaging in acts that are, while in prison, still engaging in acts, organized crime, still ordering homicides, still ordering murder, still ordering people to be victims of violent crime while in prison. And at the same time, through that intelligence apparatus, we knew that once they were released, we could no longer legally hold them. When they went back into the community, we know through intelligence that they were going to go straight back to being involved in very violent crimes, and to the point where we had people followed through the law enforcement community. So I think the focus on the whole program has to be in terms of the criminal justice or the corrections community to remind everybody, again, we're talking about some bad actors. We're not talking about everybody within the prison system. We're talking about people who pose a clear in-prison danger to our either national security or to our local security, correct?
Absolutely, Len.
And I would add a point, Len, if I could interject,
please.
Bill, is that, you know, for those who might think along the lines of civil libertarians, that, you know, once a person has been convicted and put in prison, he does not have the same rights as you and I would, you know, as law-abiding citizens in our homes. And being monitored by the appropriate authorities is both legal and most appropriate, as I think you've pointed out.
And something we're obligated to do.
Yes.
To once again protect public safety.
Absolutely. One of the issues that also came out of that is, you know, once I retired after serving 10 years in corrections and being the commissioner of correction, I came to Maryland University College and was asked to put together a state-of-the-art criminal justice program for practitioners. So the way we did that is we established an advisory board of very, very senior people in the community. And we took a hard look at our curriculum. And one of the things that everybody said unanimously is that we don't have an intelligence component for criminal justice. We really need to have that. We need to get out of stovepipes. We need to trust each other. We need to work with each other. And we have to start collecting, analyzing, and sharing intelligence if we're going to win and the bad guys are going to lose. So that's what we did. And as a result of that, we put together a certificate program in our undergraduate criminal justice program that focuses on the art and science of doing intelligence. And by going through that process, that's where I met Peter Olson. My background is in police and corrections, and I'm not really an intelligence person except for being a consumer of intelligence while I was in the military. And I had the good fortune of meeting Peter Olson through mutual friends. And Peter then came on board, and he became the advisor to UMUC in terms of intelligence. And he's been a great help to us. And not only perfecting that undergraduate certificate in intelligence, but also a master's program in intelligence management.
Well, I'm sitting here in what is affectionately known by those of us who work here, Ground Zero. I'm sitting one block away from Pennsylvania Avenue. I can see the Washington Monument. I can see the Supreme Court. Can't see the White House. The Congress is hidden by a building in front of me. But this is, you know, we within the Washington community are extraordinarily grateful of everything everything the intelligence community does, because we know that every single day when we come into downtown Washington, D.C., and I would imagine New Yorkers feel that way, and I would imagine people throughout the country feel that this way, is that we are extraordinarily grateful to the intelligence community in terms of protecting us. And that larger intelligence community extends to parole and probation agents, extends to police officers, extends to middle management. It extends to the national agencies, and there are many. If it wasn't for the intelligence community, our lives would be at risk.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, what the public doesn't know, of course, is the number of times when intelligence has, in fact, frustrated a plot that could have resulted in, you know, significant casualties or damage to Americans. You know, the challenge, of course, is that you have to be on top of it all the time, and, you know, a terrorist only has to be successful once. That is a very high standard. It's one of the issues we always have in intelligence, you know, when you're accused of an intelligence failure, that sometimes people apply an impossible standard to what's success and what's failure.
We're halfway through. I'm sorry, Peter. Let me just cut you off for a second. We're halfway through the program. Let me reintroduce the both of you and hold that thought for a second. Dr. William Zondervan, Executive Director of Public Safety Outreach, University of Maryland University College. Peter Olson, Associate Professor of Intelligence Studies, a man with an extraordinary background, and probably the most senior intelligence person I'll get to talk to in my career. I want to thank you both for being on the program. Both can be reached at www.umuc.edu, www.umuc.edu. I'm sorry, Peter, I interrupted you. Go ahead with your thought, please.
Well, I was talking about how do you judge success. And I think one of the important things for anybody thinking about intelligence is to realize that intelligence is prospective. It's looking at what might happen in the future and trying to give decision makers the information they need to take the appropriate action. It's not an investigative ex post facto activity. And so you're never always fully knowledgeable of what might happen. As a matter of fact, in intelligence analysis, I always like to use the analogy with students that it's like putting together a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle. Mm-hmm. And only somebody tore the picture off the cover of the box, so you don't really know what the picture is supposed to look like. And when you open up the box, you find that, you know, anywhere from 30 to 60% of the pieces are missing. And yet your job is to describe in detail what is that picture. That's the challenge that intelligence faces.
And Bill, that same intelligence package comes down all the way to the local level in terms of people in prison who we know. I mean, we had, when I was working for the Maryland Department of Public Safety while you were there, it was all sorts of times where we had individuals followed as soon as the person was released from the gate, because we knew we had hard, strong intelligence that person was headed straight towards a series of violent crimes in terms of an associate or in compliance, or they had accomplices that as a group they were going to go out and commit violent crimes. So it's just not keeping a dirty bomb from going off on Pennsylvania Avenue. It's keeping individuals who are avowed violent criminals from going out and hurting other human beings.
Well, it's even deeper than that, Len. It's not only when they leave, when they go on the outside. It's also, like you alluded to earlier, what they're doing while they're still in prison. And, you know, they can commit crimes from behind bars. And I think a lot of people in the police field think that when an inmate gets locked up and he goes behind the walls of a prison, he automatically puts on a halo and he becomes a good doobie. But that's not the case at all. But what we uncovered is that people were running drug empires. They were putting hits on people. They were intimidating people. They were defrauding people. And it goes on and on. So a big piece of that as a corrections professional, and that's really my expertise, is to prevent that from happening while they're in there and in being able to share the intelligence we have with the parole and probation people, with the police people in the community, so that they can prevent the violent acts when they go out.
And I just want to be, again, reemphasizing certain points that what we're talking about is not all prisoners. We're not talking about 50% of prisoners. We're talking about a subset that we know are engaged in acts that are obviously dangerous to public safety.
That's true. And a lot of the inmates don't do that, but it's a small percentage of them. But that small percentage can cause a lot of damage.
Well, one of the interesting things about the custodial setting, the prison setting, is that the best sources of information we have are our fellow inmates, because they don't want the problems. They don't want any trouble. They don't want violence erupting, nor do they want violence erupting in their own home communities. The best source of information we have are the inmates themselves, because they see the intelligence sharing process as something that keeps them safe and something that keeps their community safe.
No, you're absolutely right. The majority of inmates just want to do their time. They want to be safe themselves. They want their families to be safe, and they just want to do their time, be productive. A lot of them want to work. They want to go to school. And so, quite frankly, a lot of the inmates wind up being informants, and a lot of the inmates tell prison officials what's going on, and it's really a good source of intelligence to put together that piece of the puzzle that Peter was talking about. You know, you have to gather intelligence from a variety of different sources and try to make it all fit and try to get a good picture of what's really happening.
Peter, now, there are so many intelligence-related agencies that we have in this country, ranging mm-hmm. anywhere from probably a dozen federal agencies. I think I've read it one
17,
point.
Actually.
17 federal agencies, all the way to the New York City Police Department that's sending their own people overseas to gather intelligence. And they've been able to stop crimes, acts of terrorism from happening in New York because of that. So it's a huge
Indeed.
Apparatus. And the criticism before 911 is that we weren't sharing information. Are we now sharing information?
Well, I mean, before 9/11, there were actually legal restrictions in sharing information that you weren't allowed to do it. And part of that grew out of the investigations of the intelligence community in the 1970s with the Church and Pike committees and the subsequent executive orders and laws. And nobody in the intelligence business wanted to be criticized for doing things wrong, so that they were overly conservative, in my view. Much of that has changed. The prohibitions on sharing certain kinds of information, such as grand jury information, with intelligence people has been swept away with subsequent laws. The imperative to share is being emphasized very much by senior managers. The current Director of National Intelligence, Jim Clapper, his major theme for managing the federal intelligence community is related to integration, which really means sharing and getting the information that somebody needs to them, either for analytical purposes or for making some kind of executive decision. And I think he has pushed that ahead rather well and rather dramatically. And Jim's a strong manager. I've known him many, many years. The importance about sharing really has two things. And in my view, if you've spent a lot of time and effort collecting intelligence and you don't use it, you frankly wasted that time and energy.
Mm-hmm.
And worse yet, you may be sitting on something that somebody else really needs. And the ex post facto investigations that we've had of 9/11, even back of Pearl Harbor, we had the information oftentimes that we needed, but we just didn't put it together properly, and it didn't get into the right hands. That was truly the case at Pearl Harbor, because neither General Short nor Admiral Kimmel, who were the commanders out there at the time, were privy to the fact that we were reading Japanese diplomatic communications, and that clearly indicated that hostilities were
about to break
horizon.
Out. Yes.
And so they were caught unprepared and pilloried for it, and I think somewhat unjustifiably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They turned out to be scapegoats, yes.
But, this is not a unique problem. It's happened many times. In the intelligence business, you always have a conundrum between the secrecy of your source and your desire to protect that source, whether mm-hmm. that be an individual or a technical means that can easily be thwarted, and sharing the information. And frankly, the risk of revelation or leak goes up with the amount of sharing you do. You know, that's the inevitable problem you have, and how you balance those is, you know, takes decisions every day by a lot of people.
Well, the same thing, we have the same problem here, that a community supervision officer, what is commonly known as a parole and probation agent in the mm-hmm. rest of the country, will gain information, and it'll be that a person is about to engage in a series of violent crimes, part of a gang retribution, share that information mm-hmm. with MPD at the same time having to protect their source. So all of us at all levels of the criminal justice system suffer through that sort of ethical decision in terms of protecting the source while sharing the information.
Absolutely. There's an interesting observation I would make also, and that is sort of how intelligence and law enforcement activities are merging since 9/11. I mean, it used to be in the Cold War that intelligence focused on foreign armies and foreign countries. But since the terrorist attacks and with the growth of international criminal organizations, intelligence is increasingly focused on what the intelligence community calls subnational groups. You know, you can say, you know, it's individuals or small groups of individuals, which has always been the focus of law enforcement. And what you're seeing in the case of New York City, as you pointed out, is an organization that is a police organization using intelligence, I think, quite effectively. And I might comment that, you know, Ray Kelly's positioning of New York City police officers overseas brings the expertise of a cop to the scene of foreign terrorist incidents, which really gives us insight and better analysis than you're going to get, say, from a CIA officer who's stationed in the embassy who is not a trained investigator. I mean, his purpose is entirely different. And so I think that that has benefited not only New York, but because New York does share information, it's benefited all of us.
We have 3 minutes left in the program. Either one of you can address this question. To me, the intelligence sharing apparatus is absolutely necessary to protect me, protect our communities, to protect our children, to protect our welfare, to protect our jobs. It's absolutely critical, absolutely necessary. The information has to be shared, but yet many within the larger American community are a little frightened and a bit overwhelmed by the intelligence gathering and sharing process. They see it as a bit Orwellian. They see it as overbearing, that there's a fine line to be walked in terms of protecting the public and you know, being overly zealous in terms of the collection of information. There are endless examples of criminal justice organizations and intelligence communities who did go overboard, who did collect the wrong intelligence from the wrong people at the wrong time. So how do you address that?
Well, Len, that's why oversight by independent groups is absolutely essential, whether it be from the intelligence committees in Congress or whether it be things like the Intelligence Oversight Board in the White House or, you know, shall I say, an independent group at a local community level that has all the appropriate access and who can always be a check and balance. I mean, that's the basic nature of our government, is checks and balances. And when you deal with civil liberties, checks and balances are critically important.
But I do want to emphasize in the final minutes is that the individual intelligence officers, the individual police officers, the individual parole and probation agents also understand their constitutional duties in terms of the privacy of individuals and when it's necessary to gather information to protect public safety. They understand that as well, correct?
They're basically well-trained, but, you know, you can face ethical questions every day. This is not a simple world. It's a very complex one. And the fact that we've done so well at the individual level, I think, is a remarkable testament to the American law enforcement community and the intelligence officers who support them.
Okay, Bill, we got about 30 seconds left. Go ahead and wrap up.
I just wanted to add that at UMUC, we've taken on the mission to prepare people to go into a multitude of agencies, all the criminal justice agencies, and be intelligence specialists and analysts. And a part of the program, we have incorporated the legal and ethical issues involved in intelligence besides the theory and the practice. So our whole goal is to produce graduates that can go out in the field and be advisors to leaders of agencies and help them do these things and do them properly.
That everybody pretty much understands the limitations and understands their roles. I think that's what you're trying to say. I mean,
exactly, and that's
what everybody who's listening to this radio show needs to understand, that it's just not congressional oversight. The individual officers pretty much know where they can go and where they can't, but they got to go where they got to go to protect public safety.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
All right. Ladies and gentlemen, I really want to thank you for listening today. Our guests have been Dr. William Sondervan, the Executive Director for Public Safety Outreach, University of Maryland University College, www.umuc.edu, 94,000 students. That's a huge university. Joining him today is Peter Olson, Associate Professor for Intelligence Studies. Again, a person with an extraordinary background. And to Peter, you can, again, the website, once again, it's the same for the University of Maryland University of College, www.umuc.edu. Ladies and gentlemen, this is DC Public Safety. We thank you for your interest in calls and letters, and please have yourselves a very, very pleasant day.